Welcome to Periodical Radio, a program about magazines and journals. I'm your host, Steve Black, librarian at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York, and author of the book Serials in Libraries, Issues and Practices. With many magazines and journals, the title and a quick glance at the content immediately let you know what to expect. Figuring out what Wooden Boat or True West are about is hardly rocket science. But occasionally, there's a periodical that must be read in full, and even then can't be summarized in a sentence or two. Meat Paper is one of those publications. Based in San Francisco, it is a quarterly independent publication of 40 to 50 pages per issue. Launched in 2007, Meat Paper is a well-designed, colorful, and serious magazine that addresses the role of meat in our culture from a surprising variety of perspectives. It's not a cooking magazine, but it has a few recipes. It's not a hunting magazine, but it has a few hunting stories. It's not anti-meat, but there's a story about a store dedicated to fake meat made of soy or gluten. There's poetry, humor, and depictions of art featuring meat. One story is about meats Native Americans ate, like beaver tail, buffalo, and rattlesnake. There's a story about kosher slaughtering, an interview with a meat inspector, and an article challenging the view that prehistoric men brought home all the protein. Images include Ponca Indians skinning a buffalo, a portrait composed of ground beef on a white background, Sylvester Stallone as Rocky in the meat locker, and a woman in a flank steak dress. What to make of all of this? To wrap my mind around what Meat Paper is all about, and to bring you along for the ride, my guest is co-editor Amy Standen. She shares editing Meat Paper with Sasha Wazanski. So Amy, welcome to Periodical Radio.
Good to be here.
Meat Paper is described on your cover as your journal of meat culture. What is meat culture and why have a magazine about it?
Meat culture is something that Sasha and I have just been sort of watching with amusement take shape over the last few years. And it's this growing sort of curiosity about meat and meat, of course, as a food, but also meat as a metaphor. You would not believe how many artists we meet who are painting really beautiful, detailed, you know, oil paintings of meat. How many artists, sculptors, who are using meat as an actual medium for their work? Meat is just this really rich metaphor. It's something that's sort of troubling. It reminds us of our own bodies. It reminds us of our mortality and our relationship with animals. But then, of course, you know, meat as a food is something that there's more and more talk of these days. Chefs are looking into ways of using the entire animal, not just parts of it. I know people who are signing up for amateur butchering classes, you know, right and left. We're seeing that all across the country. People who are learning to hunt who have never hunted before. It's what we call the Fleischgeist. It's this sort of explosion of interest in meat.
Is there any Fleischgeist, the play on the word Zeitgeist, is of German origin. Is there anything particularly Germanic about meat culture?
I don't think so, not that I know of. That would be certainly interesting if there were. I mean, I should say we've had some interest from Germany. We've been written up in a German art magazine, the name of which I'm forgetting, and I think we even have a couple subscribers in Germany. But no, I don't really think this is particular to any nationality, though certainly where we see it most is in the States.
Something Meat Paper does very clearly is show the many ways people have relationships with meat, both literally and metaphorically. You touched on several of those areas. I'd like to ask you to expand on a few of those that I'll mention that have been featured in the magazine so far. Let's start with meat as imagery in art and cinema. Can you explain a little about that?
Sure. Well, we ran a piece a couple issues ago about meat's starring role in movies over the past, basically since movies began. We have, Rocky punching a meat in the meat locker to work out. Meat is sort of this, you know, in that movie, it was sort of this symbol of raw masculinity and also sort of the working class. You know, only people of a certain class, back in those days at least, really encountered meat in that form. You know, upper classes would only see meat after it had been prepared. And so the sort of, you know, rawness and disturbingness of that meat and its class connotations were really powerful in that movie. But then you have other movies where meat is is just, I'm thinking of The Cook, The Thief, His Wife and Her Lover, which actually isn't, I'm not sure he wrote about it, that story, but where you have meat that is just supposed to shock us, you know, and not a superficial shock, but it's a real, it's a confrontation with something very troubling and you know, something that has a visceral sort of power over us as human beings. I think, you know, filmmakers, of course, you know, there's the famous horse head in the Godfather. Few things you could put in someone's bed on a morning that would disturb them more than a huge, you know, piece of meat. It's a way of sort of cutting straight to a very basic human instinct, and in a lot of films, a real human fear.
How about meat as a business?
As a business?
Yes.
Well, that's something we're seeing changing. I mean, meat is, you know, once upon a time, there was only really one kind of meat to get, at least here in the States, you know, in a sort of mass market kind of way. And that was meat that came from huge industrial ranches. And now we have this whole new industry that's grown up that is based on this idea of starting small, of treating the animals well, of feeding them, you know, in the case of cows, grass instead of corn, and of giving people a direct connection to sort of the lives that their animals led. And I don't have any numbers to back this up, but I think anyone would tell you that this is an exploding industry. It's connected, of course, to the interest in slow food and the interest in sustainability in general. But this is really a business that didn't exist 25 years ago, at least certainly at the scale we have it now. So I think there's a very strong business angle. And then there's, of course, you know, meat CSAs, this idea of ranches selling meat just to a club of people so you could buy direct from the ranch and have a relationship with a particular ranch and go to the place where that animal lived. All of these things were, you know, didn't exist before, and there wasn't a real interest in them before, but this is just part of the zeitgeist.
How about hunting stories? There's a few in the magazine. Our relationship with meat in terms of hunting.
Yeah, well, I mean, Michael Pollan had this very influential, first an essay that a lot of us read in the New York Times, and then it was also in The Omnivore's Dilemma, the scene where he goes hunting. And he, you know, like a lot of sort of urban foodie people, you know, environmentalists, had never been hunting before. And felt like, well, you know, if I'm going to eat meat, I should really have the experience of going out and killing it myself and preparing it and sort of, you know, seeing the entire process that brings an animal to my dinner plate. And so I don't know if that's what started it, but I hear more and more and more people who are, apparently the guy who took Michael Pollan hunting is just besieged by requests to take other people out hunting. There is a real interest of people who had no necessarily strong sort of outdoors experience, certainly didn't grow up in rural areas, but who are saying, I want to hunt, I want to see what that's like. And I think a lot of people come back from those trips and say, you know what, I think maybe I don't want to eat animals anymore. But a lot of other people say, you know, I'm going to keep eating animals, but the experience of having killed it myself makes me realize how important it is that I eat animals that lived a decent life. So we hear a lot of that.
How about cooking rituals? Not just cooking to cook, but the ritual of cooking.
The ritual of cooking. Well, that's something we hear a lot about. We had a story in, I think, our first issue about a goat slaughter in Mexico. Am I getting that right? Yeah, I think so. And this very long ritual of preparing this animal, cooking the blood, various dishes, making, I think they made sausage from its intestines. And this was a ritual that took 3 days that had special rules for different members of the family. And the more you hear about, when you happen to edit a meat magazine, you start collecting these kinds of stories from different cultures about how meat is prepared and ritualistically prepared. Of course, Native American traditions have very strong role of ritual in the preparation of, you know, bison or any large animal. I think you just find in cultures that meat is a serious thing. You know, it's rare, it's incredibly nourishing, And there is very often a recognition that this is an animal that we had a relationship while it was alive, and that relationship is changing, and we need to sort of mark that transition somehow. That's a very, very common thing. And that's something that really had been lost in American culture, mostly. And, you know, to the extent that people who are really interested in food practice rituals, I think we're sort of starting to see a little more of that come back.
How about our relationship with meat as a metaphor of how women are depicted?
Well, that was probably, you know, when you look at some of the, not the early meat art, but the early contemporary meat art. So Yana Sterbach is a Canadian artist who did the first really sort of seminal piece of meat art, and I think it was the early 90s. She made a dress out of flank steak and hung it on this sort of wan, emaciated model. And people were just really freaked out by this dress. You know, it just really sort of shocked them. It didn't sit well with a lot of people. And what Yana Sterbach's point, and the point we've seen a lot of other women artists make since then, is that when you dress a woman in meat, or, you know, have a woman interacting with meat, you're really making a statement about how women have traditionally been looked at in culture as sort of, you know, an object, a piece of meat, something to possess and devour, something without agency of its own, and something that, you know, something only of flesh without a real sentience that anyone cares about. That's a, you know, dramatic statement, but I think that's the point that that a lot of feminist artists have made over time and just, you know, to some extent continue to make. So we definitely saw a big movement of that, in the sort of late, early 90s, through the 90s.
I had the general sense reading Meat Paper that the general perspective is a feminist perspective. Would you agree with that?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, I think that, you know, to the extent that its editors are women, I guess you would say that our perspective is feminist. But, you know, if it was a magazine put together by two men, you probably wouldn't say that it was a chauvinist, not in a negative way, but, you know, a masculine perspective on meat. I think both of us, of course, are interested in, actually, you know, I would say we're really just interested in everything. And I think feminist depictions of meat are interesting, but I also think that, you know, stories about meat that really have nothing to do with any particular gender or, you know, you know, polemical objective are interesting too. I mean, I consider myself a feminist, but like anyone else, that's just one of the ways that I look at the world, certainly not the only one.
Sure. And I, one of the things I really notice with Meat Paper is, you know, in trying to come up with a description of it, it's impossible to pigeonhole. And I get the sense that you and Sasha are really striving to look at meat culture from every conceivable perspective. Is that a goal of yours?
Yeah, definitely. And one of the things we've always been clear about, at least with each other, and we've always tried to make it clear in all our editors' letters and whenever we do an interview, is that we really aren't taking a stand on what most people consider to be sort of the big question around meat, which is whether or not it's ethical to eat it. We have in issue three, we have two interviews right next to each other. One is with a woman who slaughters animals in her backyard and eats them very enthusiastically. And then the other one is with a guy named Jeffrey Mason, who is a very well-known animal rights activist who lives in New Zealand and a very serious vegan who makes the point that if an animal is sentient, has feelings, emotions, experience of the world, we have no right to take its life from it, that the animals have a right to life just the way humans do. And I find that a very powerful argument. So I think we have always wanted to have all perspectives. We think that being a vegetarian is a reaction to meat, just the same way that being a, you know, omnivore is a reaction to meat. And all of those things are part of the Fleischgeist.
The other day at Easter dinner, eating our ham and lamb, one of my nieces said that if people had to kill their own animals for meat, if they had to do the killing process, that everyone would be vegetarian. And in a way, you've already answered that. But what would you personally say to my niece if you'd been sitting there and she asked your opinion?
I think she's right that a lot more people would be vegetarian. But, you know, I mean, we have in most cultures throughout history, up until ours, people did kill their own animals. You know, anyone who grows up on a farm, probably a big farm, kills animals and eats them. And so I think that people have been killing animals and eating them for a long time. But I do think that what she's getting at is that you care when you kill an animal. And I haven't killed an animal, at least a big one, so this is what I hear. But when you kill an animal, you care about that animal. Not that you necessarily need it to live, but you have a real reason to be interested in the kind of life it led and the kind of death that it experiences. I think you're more likely to want that death to be quick and painless, and you would more, you know, incentive to spare the animal from pain and fear before the death. So I think she's absolutely right that we would have a different take on eating animals. And I think probably a lot of people would say, I'm not going to eat animals anymore. But I certainly don't think, you know, carnivorism would become extinct if we suddenly had to all kill our own animals. I think people get used to it, you know.
Mm-hmm. The conventional wisdom in magazine publishing is you need a really tightly defined and targeted audience to attract advertisers and gain subscribers. And Meat Paper has this eclectic view of the meat culture, which is a topic that most people wouldn't immediately know what it means before they look into it a little bit. Mm-hmm. So given all of that, who's your audience? And you know, in this context, who's your audience? Who are you trying to reach?
Sure. I certainly don't know who all our subscribers are by a long shot, but I think we've always felt like our target audience is people a lot like ourselves in some respects and not necessarily in others. So I think those are going to be people who have a real interest in, who are curious people, people who have a real interest in what other cultures are doing and in art and in food and who like to take a deeper look at something, which is a very vague description, but I think you'd probably describe the readers of, you know, The New Yorker or Harper's or Cabinet or, you know, these are all magazines that basically hang on an editorial direction that is just curiosity and quality. And so I put us in those groups of magazines. I'd say we're even a little more tightly defined because we have this single theme to our magazine, which is meat. And there is no magazine anything like that, like Meat Paper. And that's served us really well.
Who are your writers and how do you recruit them?
They've really just the bigger we get, the broader our subscription base, the more bookstores we end up in, they really just come to us. I should be doing more recruiting of writers than I actually do, but we end up with a lot of people who pick up the magazine, who think it's really interesting, or who Sasha and I know because I'm a writer and a radio producer and Sasha is a designer, and so she meets a lot of artists. And people come to us and they say, I have this idea, you know, they just kind of get it, you know, oh, you must be, this just seems like a great place for the story I've been kicking around in my head for a while. So we get submissions all the time. We get a ton of them, and we, you know, of course, like anyone else, turn down most of them. But I would say, really, our writers have just been sort of coming to us so far.
Who does your graphic design? I thought it was very good. I take it Sasha?
Yeah, it's all Sasha. Sasha takes complete credit for that. I mean, and she should. We have a lot of illustrators and artists who contribute in various ways, but Sasha is the designer.
How did you guys learn how to produce a magazine?
We kind of figured it out as we went along. It was really something, it's been a real learning experience for us. I mean, I have a background in journalism. Sasha has a background in graphic design and print production, so she knew printers. She knew, you know, how to design a magazine, mostly. I would say that the other parts of this, subscribers, advertising, the whole business end of it has been something that we've really just figured out, you know, bulk mail. The business of running a magazine has been... You know, I mean, it's been really humorous, actually, and really fun, and every issue is drastically easier to put together than the previous issue. But we've pretty much made it up as we go along. And we ask for help from a lot of people. And we've had someone who helps us sell ads, too, which is a really critical part of it.
I noticed that so far Meat Paper has fairly few advertisements. Do you think a big meat factory corporation like Tyson or Simplot would ever advertise in meat paper?
I wouldn't want to rule it out. I mean, I wouldn't want to. We need more ads, and I wouldn't, I wouldn't rule out the possibility of somebody like that advertising. I think they would be smart to. I mean, of course, I'm as biased as an opinion as you could get on this, but I think that anyone who is dealing with the meat industry these days is seeing that it is changing and that people want something very different from their meat producers than they used to. I live near a Safeway, and I also live near a tiny sort of artisan butcher shop that does only meat sort of from Northern California, meat that was raised sustainably, and that place is packed all the time. They have lines out the door. And so I think if you are a meat company, you are seeing that you need to start taking a more intelligent kind of line to your customers. You need to start giving them more information. You need to start treating them like, intelligent people and not just people who blindly buy whatever's on the grocery store shelf. So, I feel like advertising in meat paper would be a great way to demonstrate that new consciousness. But, I'm sure that's a case we'll try and make at some point, but we really haven't yet.
Launching a new magazine is always risky business, even for big companies with deep pockets. Are you and Sasha glad you took the plunge?
Oh, yeah, of course. It's been fun. And we actually, we're doing fine. We work for free. I mean, we both have day jobs. This has not been a big moneymaker, and we certainly weren't expecting it to be a big moneymaker initially. We've been only pleasantly surprised by sort of, how well we're doing, how many bookstores we're in, how many subscribers, and what we see is a constant growth. So, no, it's been a really, really fun experience. I mean, very tiring and everything else, but what an adventure.
Is it the classic kitchen table, or do you guys actually have an office?
I would say it's definitely of the classic kitchen table, living room, apartment living room scenario. Yes, we look a lot glossier than the impression you would have if you came and saw us around production time.
A few months ago, I interviewed the editor of Wooden Boat magazine, based in Maine, mm-hmm. and it started as a kitchen table publication in the '60s, and now it's a very large enterprise.
Well, that is a great example for us. I mean, I think you do see new magazines starting up all the time. And they get investors, and they hire a staff, and they pay, they hire really famous writers and photographers and everything, and they create a huge amount of debt, and the risk is just gigantic. And we, neither of us, we just don't have the resources to do that. So we were forced by our own, basically, very, very simple salaries to keep this small. And so we have kept ourselves out of debt, and we've kept ourselves on a scale that we can manage. So in a way, we're sort of more sustainable than, a big risky venture like, well, I can't think of any right now. But that's been a good thing for us.
Like some Condé Nest.
Something like that, yeah, where you just have, initial outlay of $3 million
right.
or something. I mean, that's just not what we're doing. So I think we both sleep easier at night knowing that that's not the boat we're in.
Where would you like meat paper to be in 5 years?
I would like it to be nationwide. I mean, actually, I would like it to be international, and we see that happening. But, of course, our main distribution points are the coast. But we'd like to see that going into progressive towns across the country. And we'd like to see much broader international distribution. And we would like to have our content reflect that more. I mean, we do. We have a story from Israel. We've had stories from Mexico. We've had stories from Australia, I think, Tunisia. I mean, we do, we really try and keep this international balance going, but we would like to develop that even more. I don't think, we need this to be the scale of a Condé Nast publication, but I think we would be very happy if we were reaching people all around the world with common interest, and also that we were getting contributions from all around the world.
Well, Amy, thank you very much for speaking with me today. I very much appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having us on. Great to talk to you.
Okay. Subscriptions to Meat Paper are $28 for 4 issues per year. Subscriptions details are online at www.meatpaper.com/subscribe. Thank you for listening to Periodical Radio. I'm your host, Steve Black.
Thank you.